Daniel Sprong from the wall. Sprong steps up, fires, blocked, loose puck, Everly to Schwartz, loose puck, they score! Jordan Everly wins it for Seattle!
My favorite player on my favorite team. Jordan Everly. I knew. Said he's my favorite player.
I knew that'd be how you led the show, you know.
Well, of course. I'm not gonna lead with your boring D-back cut where the Royals lose. Every day in sports you lead off with the Royals losing. I'm like, I want something positive, uplifting, and I'm gonna do something different, and I'm gonna go with my team and my favorite player, as I just said the other day. And the reason he's my favorite player is because his last name is Everly, and there's Everlys that live here in North Central Kansas, and they're probably related way, way, way down the family tree. So, and his first name's Jordan, and my favorite NBA player was Michael Jordan. So it all ties together.
Exactly.
Yeah. Don't rain on my parade. At least I have a...
I'm not raining on it. I'm just saying I knew that's how it would
lead.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. Well, I'm not starting with the dang D-back scoring a run to beat the Royals. How demoralizing and depressing is that? I don't need this show to be depressing. I want this show to be uplifting. And I've got a team in its second year of existence when its first ever home playoff game last night. And on top of that, they tied the series at 2-2 with the Colorado Avs, defending Stanley Cup champions, are being pushed to the brink by a team in its second year of existence. By a guy named Jordan Everly with the game-winning goal last night in overtime. Kraken blew a 2-0 lead, won it in overtime. That series is tied at 2 apiece as they win 3-2 last night in overtime. Pretty exciting stuff. The Golden Knights picked up another win in Winnipeg. They take game 4-4-2. They're up 3-1 after losing game 1. And that wasn't the only exciting game last night. Seattle, the Avs, there's another good one.
Return it, Nylander to Giordano with a shot. Tip score!
The Maple Leafs lost game 1. Everybody's freaking out in Toronto. Here we go. Same old Maple Leafs choking. Haven't won a playoff series since like 2004, I think it was. They lost game 1, gave up 7 goals. Now they've won 3 games in a row, won 5-4 in overtime last night in Tampa. So they go back to Toronto for game 5. New Jersey Devils are down 2-0. They've now won 2 in a row over the Rangers. The road team's won every game of that series. That's tied at 2-2. 3 game 5s tonight on the schedule. The Hurricanes in the East have a 3-1 lead on the Islanders. They host Game 5 at 6 o'clock tonight on ESPN. In the West, you got the Stars and Wild tied at 2 apiece. Pivotal Game 5, 7 o'clock on TBS. And the Oilers at home against the LA Kings on ESPN at 8:30. That series tied at 2 apiece as well. So, yes, call me a guilty. I start with uplifting stuff, something exciting and fun. Unless you're a D-back fan, then you'll love the the cut we're going to play in a little bit. Local sports, Dusty.
Yes, baseball yesterday. The Beloit gets a sweep over Republic County, winning 12-2 in 5 innings in game 1, and take the second game 15-2 in 5 as well. Beloit's now 8-8, 5-3 in the NCAAs. Republic County dropped to 3-13 and 1-7 in league play. And then in golf yesterday, the Concordia Invitational. Clay Center won that team championship, 325 ahead of Concordia in second with 331. Danny Jackson of Chapman was the individual champion with a 77. Luke Donovan of Concordia finished with a 78 and had a third place medal there. The full results for the Concordia Golf Invitational can be found at ncksports.com. Schedule for today, not quite as busy as some Tuesdays have been here during the spring, but we do have Rock Hills Golf Invitational this afternoon at 1 o'clock. Lakeside, Pike Valley, Rock Hills, St. John's, Southern Cloud, and Tipton, all from the area competing in that one. Also in high school baseball today, Sylvan Lucas at Lincoln at Ellsworth at 4 o'clock. Abilene's at Concordia at 4:30. Abilene Concordia in baseball and softball today at 4:30, and then Sylvan Lucas softball will be at Nass City this afternoon at 4 o'clock with a doubleheader as well. So that's a look at what's going on in local sports today. And again, as always, check out ncksports.com for all the latest scores, standing schedules, and what you need there for North Central Kansas sports.
So Beloit was playing Republic County last night in Belleville, and I got up there for the second game. First game they won 12-2 in 5 innings. And so I go up there for the second game. There's not a lot of bleachers there at the baseball field at Republic County in Belleville, but there's plenty of places to set up your lawn chair, so forth and so on. So the second game, Beloit scores 2, Republic County scores 2. It's 2-2 after the first. And then Quinn Eilert apparently had a hot date that he had to get to because he just was like pitching BB after BB, but also it's like the batters barely had time to set up in the box. I don't know why the Republic County coaches didn't say a little bit more, because the umpire talked to Quinn a little bit in between innings, like, dude, you got to let him set up. But Quinn was just ready to go. He was in a rhythm. Now, if I was coaching against Quinn last night, I would have had my guy come down the line. Hey, I got to talk to you. I would try to break up his rhythm. I would be like, hey, ask for time the whole time until you're comfortable and in the box. I would have slowed him down a little bit, but he was really pitching well last night. He threw like 60 pitches and went five innings.
Mm-hmm.
That's super efficient. That's pretty awesome. Lance Lundin had a couple diving catches, although I think Lance is just showboating now. I think he's in right field. He can make that catch standing up, but he's just like, you know what would really be cool is if mom could get me diving for a great catch and I have this really cool thing I can use when I graduate, which will be in my senior collage of me diving to make a catch.
Yeah.
And I remember there was a center fielder. I forgot what team he played for. I forgot the name of the guy. But I remember hearing this story. He was a really good defensive player back, I think, in the 90s. And the team, his teammates always gave him static and said, you don't even run hard. That's why every play is a diving catch. You make these great catches, but they should be routine, you know? So I'm just giving Stretch a little bit of a little hard time there. He made two really nice plays. But the highlight for me, personally, selfishly, was watching my son be the extra hitter. That's right. He is, you know, he's all of 5'8", 122, but he's the extra hitter. And last night, put the ball in play every time, had a couple base hits or something like that, a sac fly to center, whatever. That's great. I'm not bragging about my kid for his individual glory other than this. So there's runners on second and third, and he's down two strikes in the count. And all you say is put the ball in play. How many times have we talked in baseball? And we tell our young kids, I'm coaching nine and under kids, like, whatever you do, don't watch strike three go right down the middle of the plate. Mm. I don't care if you strike out, but strike out swinging. You have a bat, use it. You have a bat for a reason. Take it off your shoulder. Don't look for a walk. No matter what age a baseball player you are, the worst thing you can do is take a called third strike right down the pipe, a fastball right down the middle. And I've seen some kids that we've coached for years continue to do it, and it drives me insane. At least swing. If you strike out swinging, at least you swung it. You know the other pitcher needs to throw a strike when it's 3-2, right? You know, yeah. Or if it's 0-2, it's close. You got to protect the plate. You got to widen the zone a little bit, as we say. And I saw recently there was a bases loaded, two outs, bottom of the ninth game. I think it was the Padres. And it was a 3-2 pitch, and it was down the middle, and the guy watched it. And the game's over. I've never seen a major league hitter do that before. Bases loaded, 3-2 count, and he takes it. He was looking for a walk. He's a professional hitter, paid $100,000, you know, $500,000, whatever, if he's a veteran minimum or whatever, major league minimum. And I'm sitting here, I'm like, dude, that is, you know how much static he caught from the dugout, from his coaches and everybody? I guarantee you heard about it. Like, you got to take the bat off your shoulder, son. No matter if you're pro, college, high school, 9-year-old, we tell our kids, like, listen, if you're going to strike out, that's fine. People strike out all the time. It happens all the time in the major leagues nowadays. So, but at least go down swinging. You know, granted, we don't want you swinging at one that's 6 feet high into the backstop, although if it's strike three, you should make it to first anyway, because it's not a caught third strike, unless first base is occupied, so forth and so on. So last night, my oldest son, he pops one up. He puts the ball in play. Here's an example. And the reason I share this example, not necessarily because it was my son, but because it was the wildest play of the game. And also, it shows why you swing the bat with two strikes and putting the ball in play is good. Remember the Royals back in 14 and 15? They played small ball. They didn't strike out a lot. They put the ball in play. And what happened? Toronto right fielder and second baseman don't call a play. Ball drops. Daniel Murphy lets the ball between his legs. Putting the ball in play. For crying out loud, how about the mad dash home for Hosmer? That was a weak ground ball that was put in play, probably with two strikes, and Hosmer went home on that play on David Wright's throw the first. Good things happen when you put the ball in play. If you can just put the pressure on the other team. And that's one thing that irritates me and infuriates me about Major League Baseball nowadays is that there's so many guys swinging for the fences. They're trying to pull the ball. They're missing the ball completely. You've got to stay in. You got to keep your posture straight. You got to step towards the pitcher. These are fundamentals, 101. And then you take the ball where it leads you. Like, when you're hitting, you shouldn't be trying to hit the ball the other way every time. You shouldn't be trying to pull the ball all the time. You shouldn't be trying to hit a home run when you're at the plate. I mean, the best home run hitters will tell you, at least back in the day, that nice level swings, if you're trying to lift the ball, you're in trouble. Andrew Benintendi, he was in Boston, and he had a really good rookie year, and they won the World Series that year, I believe. And then they had the shorter park at Boston, and then the Major League Baseball went towards, hey, we're not going to run as much. We're waiting for the three-run homer. And Andrew Benintendi was taught to try to swing more of an uppercut and to try to swing for the fences. And Andrew Benintendi's career went in the toilet. And then everybody talked about how he was a bust. He couldn't figure it out. He goes to Kansas City, right? He gets traded to the Royals and becomes an all-star. Not a superstar, but he was an all-star. He goes to Kansas City and hits over 300 almost all the time. And what changed? Because he was in a pitcher's park. He knew he wasn't going to hit 30 home runs. Mm-hmm. And so he learned how to go back to his approach, which was line drives. And he hit some home runs at times. And he would get extra. He was one of the best hitters in extra base hits in regards to doubles. Even got a few triples. He put the ball in play. He was totally back the way he was. He got away from who he was because somebody told him, you got to hit home runs, which is just stupid. And so what happens is you see other kids that try to do this. They're trying to hit home runs all the time. Or they hit one, and then they think they're a home run hitter, and they can hit home runs all the time. I will tell you, my kid knows he can't hit home runs, so he's not going to be trying to swing for the fences. If he hits a home run over the fence, it'll be the shortest park in all of high school baseball. Or he just the wind is blowing out. Or he just got really lucky, okay? And then if he's going to start trying to swing and hit home runs after that, he's going to really struggle, right? Mm-hmm. As in any kid will. So anyway, with two strikes, he puts the ball in play. And it's a high, and the third baseman, every time my son came up, look out for the bunt! Like, you know what? He hasn't tried to bunt yet, but okay. So the third baseman starts to scoot up. Just because he's smaller doesn't mean he just bunts all the time. Third baseman starts scooting up. There's two strikes, which I don't know why he was up a little bit on two strikes. Usually you don't bunt with two strikes. Mm-hmm. And he didn't even show bunt, I don't think. Anyway, he pops it up, and it's deep on the infield over the third baseman head. But he goes back, and he tracks it. And it's the ball doesn't even get to the grass, right? The outfield grass. And so the third baseman goes backwards, kind of contorting his body. It was not an easy play. And it looked like he had it in his glove. He was going to have a catch. We had runners at second and third. And then the ball, I don't know if it fell out of his glove, if he dropped it, or as he went down to the ground, stumbled and lost it. Maybe he never cleanly had it. My view was that I thought he dropped it. Okay, so the ball hits the dirt. Not the outfield grass, okay? You with me?
Mm-hmm.
Runners at second and third. So the ball drops, and then the runner from third, of course, is staying close to third, thinking it's going to be caught. Then all of a sudden, he takes off, which I don't know if that was I don't know if that was great, but it worked out. So the runner takes off from third to home. He goes home, and the throw to home is wild. The ball gets away. Now the runner from second is rounding third, so now he decides to come try to score, and they throw another throw to home from the catcher, chasing a loose ball down from the first errant throw back to the pitcher covering the bag at home, and mm-hmm. that's a wild throw. And I'm sitting here and I'm watching these two runners from second and third scoring after my kid hits a weak little pop up to third base. Next thing I know, I look to my left, here comes my son roaring around third. I'm like, oh my god, he's gonna get the little league home run in high school, and the ball didn't even get to the grass. And sure as heck, he scored standing up. So here's how I scored it at home. Ready? Now, for all you parents that are selfish and want to pad your kid's stats, and you're worried about your kid making an error, or you're worried about your kid with, he technically didn't get out there. That was a sacrifice, or whatever you want to call it, okay? Mm-hmm. There are parents out there so worried about their kid's stats, they don't really care about the team's success. I've seen this many times over the years, and I just don't like it. So anyway, and you may say, well, you're sharing a story about your son. Yeah, but I'm sharing a story about putting the ball in play and wild things happen here, and I'm making fun of him as well, and I'm sure he greatly appreciates that. But he's at school, so he probably not listening anyway. So, well, he better not be. So here's how I scored it. Now if you've got mom and dad looking at padding their kid's stats, here's how they would score it. You ready? So here's how I would score it. Error, no RBIs, he scored a run, no at bat. That's it.
Mm-hmm.
Three errors, he doesn't get a base hit out of it, all right? You don't go, oh, he ran the bases really hard, I got to give him an RBI. No. He didn't drive in anybody. He put the ball in play. The ball should have been caught. It was not caught. And then there was error. So my son last night asked me, he goes, did I get RBIs on that play? I said, well, if they score it correctly, no. Oh. Sorry, son, not trying to be mean. I'm just being objective here. If I'm scoring it, I'm going error. Fielding error, throwing error. Now, if I look back at the replay, maybe you could call it a hit if you deem that the guy really was an extremely tough play at third. That would be an error in the majors. It'd be an error in college. High school, maybe you could somehow justify that the guy... I've always said this. If the ball hits your glove and you can't catch it, that's an error.
Mm-hmm.
And it hit his glove. There's no question about it. So I stick with the error, fielding error, throwing error, throwing error, little league home run, as we call it. Remember the back in the day, T-ball and coach pitch, you hit the ball, and the other team throws the ball around, kicks it around, and you run all the way around the bases? That's a little league home run, if you don't know. Okay? It's a little league play.
Yes.
So, that's how I would score it, and I think that's the correct way to score it. Air, air, air. Just across the board. No RBIs. But, if there's mom and dad that want to make their kid feel good, and they're officially running any kind of book that they got, all right, for whoever it may be, they may score it a base hit. All right? Maybe. Oh, that was a really tough play for the third baseman. So they give him the base hit. Okay, cool. My son's happy. Helps his average, gets a base hit. And then because it's a base hit, they're going to go ahead and give him an RBI on the first guy scoring, even though it was a wild throw and he would have been out anyway if it was a good throw. And then the second guy, maybe they'll go in air. So I think the parent that wants to pad the stats is going to say, hit, RBI, air. And I'm going to say, no, 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 and no.
No.
Those are three errors. Maybe somehow you can say it was a... Maybe you could say it's a base hit because it was a hard play at third. But you can't give them an RBI because then they picked it up and a good throw would have got the kid at third who was not running because he thought it was going to be caught and didn't want to be doubled off. And he ran home. A good throw still gets him. So to me, that's not an RBI. That's an error. A throwing error at home. So... It's funny because I'm and the home baseball games, I'm there and I got the stream stuff in front of me and I'm not calling the game play by play. And sometimes they'll be like, well, how do you score that? And I'm like, oh, well, I've been around baseball for God knows forever. And so I know usually how to score plays. And I'm like, oh, that was a tough play. That's a base hit. Like, no, it was a chopper to the third baseman. He charged in and he booted it 6 feet. That's not a base hit. That is an error. I hate to be mean, but an error is an error, okay? Oh, well, he dropped the ball. Well, it was a tough play. He had it in his glove, and then he dropped it, so it's a hit. No, it's not a hit. If anybody drops a ball, that's an error, period. So you do, and I think coaches do it too sometimes. They pad the stats of whatever the sport may be, and that's okay. Like, well, I'm going to give this kid an assist because it's a great pass, even though technically it didn't lead to a bucket. I'd be like, oh, cool, I get that. I understand that a little bit. It's kind of like a hockey assist, maybe. And not a lot of people see that. But baseball, you see the play. It's in front of everybody. And so there are places that they give a hit no matter, like, it's there. We cannot give out errors. That's just mean. Like, no, it's an error. All right? Well, it's a ground ball to short. Well, almost got him at second on the force. Yeah, he booted the ball and the guy was safe at second. That is not a base hit. That's a fielder's choice and an error. So anyway, maybe I need to work on having a class on how to score things, but, some people don't know how to score that stuff. Some people ask me for advice on how to score stuff. I don't have all the answers. Don't get me wrong. But when the ball, the guy's in position to make a catch and he doesn't make the catch, he or she, that's an error.
I would say in as a general rule, pop-ups on the infield that aren't caught are going to be errors.
Yes. Technically they aren't. Like if the wind
something like that, yeah.
You know, honestly, you don't give it. This is a true story. If a ball is up on the infield, a pop fly, and nobody tracks it, or both guys run towards the mound and both call it, and the ball drops, that's supposed to be scored a hit. Because nobody caught it.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody touched it. It's supposed to be scored a hit. Now, that's the cheapest hit you're ever going to get.
Yeah.
To me, that's a mental error, but you don't have a category for mental errors. So that's not an error. Well, I'll give you an example. The Royals a few weeks ago, we talked about this on the show. Edward Olivares, who is not a good defensive outfielder for the Royals, hit a home run last night. More on the awesome Royals in a moment. But Brady, it was last weekend, I think, or last week, middle of the week. Brady Singer pitched, and it was a line drive / fly ball to right field. And Edward Olivares completely misjudged it, and he came in on the ball. That's a play that every major league outfielder should make. That is not a super hard play for major leaguers. I don't sit here and go, well, Wade, you don't know what it's like. Trust me, I'm not saying I'd make the play. I'm not saying that at all, okay, because I didn't play outfield. But at a pro, you're supposed to make that play, unless you're a Royal. So Edward Olivares comes in on the ball. The ball flies over his head. He misjudges it. He didn't touch it with his glove. The ball goes all the way to the fence. What was it scored?
Probably hit.
It's called a double. Yeah. And that's the appropriate way. Yeah. That is the correct way to score it. So even though he screwed up and it is a mental error, now, if he comes in and he gets his glove out the last second and it glances out the top of his glove and goes all the way to the wall, that will be called an error. But because he was so bad at judging the ball, it ended up being a hit, not an error, and it counts as more earned runs against Brady Singer as ERA balloons even more. So if there's a pop-up on the infield and nobody touches it, I'm pretty sure that's supposed to be scored a hit, because who do you give the error to?
Yeah.
If two guys come over, you can't give half an error to this guy or that guy. One of the cheapest hits you could ever possibly get. So you're right. On a pop-up in the infield, it should be caught. But if the ball doesn't touch anybody's glove, it more than likely be scored a hit, which is cheap. There should be another category saying mental error.
Yeah.
I don't know. But you're right. I agree with you. Anything in the air on the infield should be caught.
And usually there's somebody around it, right? That's why why I say in general most of the time that on an infield pop-up.
A high pop-up. If there's a little tiny, little mini blooper, I mean, sometimes it can fall in front of the third baseman, those type of things. But we're talking about like a legitimate pop-up.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Those should be caught every time.
Yeah. And typically there is at least somebody around it where
usually it tips their glove and they drop it.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. And that's an error, not a hit.
Yeah.
That was a tough play. It had to come all the way in from short. Nope. Could have caught it. It was going to be a tough basket catch. It's not a hit.
Yeah.
It's an error. All right. I guess he'd be better off just backing up and letting it drop. Then he'd call it a hit and don't hurt his fielding percentage. But so anyway, the point of the story, the moral of the story I'm trying to share is when you put the ball in play, good things can happen. Mm-hmm. Obviously, you have no chance of anything good happening when you strike out. There is nothing positive about striking out. There is nothing positive about striking out.
The only thing, like what you said earlier, is if it gets
drop
past the catcher.
Strike.
Yeah.
Yep. There's nothing positive striking out. And it's even worse to me when you watch a third strike. Like, you can at least say, hey, you know what? The guy's a great pitcher. He blew me away with fastballs, but at least I was swinging instead of watching three cookies right down the middle. And that's one of the things that drives me nuts when I watch kids take a third strike at any level. What really drives me nuts is watching a kid at any level not swing the bat the whole at bat and take a third strike. Mm-hmm. Like, you didn't even foul one off. You didn't even swing at anything. Why even give you a bat? I mean, you're looking to walk. And guess what? Against good pitchers, it ain't going to happen. Not going to happen. So the good thing is, we talk about the Royals back in 14 and 15. You put the ball in play, good things happen. So this is one of the frustrations I have in Major League Baseball. I think younger kids are watching sometimes this stuff, and they're like, well, that's what they do in the big leagues. And I think the big leagues send a very poor message, and that is home run or bust. And that's not how baseball was designed for the very beginning. That's why you could say you could like the fact of a ban on the shift, because now there's more singles. Right? That you can get the ball in play and actually get on base more often now because there isn't the shift. Although there's a loophole where you can kind of do a shift right now. But whatever happened to just keeping the line moving? Because that's what the Royals called it. Keep the line moving. Instead, it's, hey, let's get a guy on first and second. We're never going to double steal. Well, we got a guy at first and third. Well, we're not going to steal second and stay out of a double play because we're waiting for that three-run bomb. And then what happens? You have runners at first and third, and you have no outs. The guy strikes out. Next guy grounds into a double play, inning over.
Yeah. We changed the rules to make more singles instead of having people actually get better at what they're doing.
Yes.
And make more singles because they actually did what they were supposed to do.
Because they're trying to do dead pull hitters and not use the whole field, which would help your average tremendously, help your team tremendously, means you get on base way more, and you put pressure on the defense by putting the ball in play. As I said, striking out, listen, baseball is one of the toughest sports to play, and one of the toughest things to do is to hit. I was not a good hitter. It is hard to hit. There's no doubt about it. But if you think of sports, if you think of all the different team sports, like I can't think of anything positive. Like, there might be something positive about certain things that happen in sports and team sports, but even if it's somewhat, like, you can spin the negative into somewhat of a positive, you know what I'm saying? But I don't know how you spin a strikeout into a positive other than when you're younger. Hey, you swung. At least you swung. Whereas when you get old enough and then you get, you know, college and pro, now that don't mean nothing. And so the strikeouts, that's why if you got a power pitcher, we saw Wade Davis, 2015 ALCS, bases loaded, Royals up a run, trying to win the pennant, didn't look promising, and he was able to get out of it with two strikeouts and a ground ball to third. And guess what? The Blue Jays didn't go to Game 7 because they couldn't put the ball in play. If the Blue Jays put the ball in play, each of those guys, I would be willing to bet you they tied that game. And then they might win it, and they might go to the World Series. But the fact they couldn't put the ball in play, they didn't shorten up on their swing, or even, God forbid, bunt, which that's a lost art, by the way, too. You know, if you got a kid, and here's the other thing. We talk about golf. Well, you got this ego, right? Well, I can't hit from the ladies' tees. Well, first of all, that's wrong. They're not ladies' tees. The front box is for the handicap that you are. So if you're a beginning golfer, whether you're a woman or a man, it doesn't matter. You should be hitting from the very front tee box. It shouldn't matter, okay? You should be hitting from the front tee box. But there is this thing where I think it's all ego and it's testosterone for men, no question. Well, I got to hit from the back or at least the middle tees because I'm a man. I ain't hitting from the women's tee box. Yeah, and then you look like a complete you-know-what when you don't even hit it past the women's tee box, which, once again, is not the women's tee box. It's the front tee box. And I think there is this ego and this manliness to Major League Baseball players, probably college, and maybe even happens high school, and even lower than that in baseball. And that is, hey, I'm struggling at the plate. Hey, you ever think about bunting? How about we bunt? We just get you going. Maybe get a little cheap bunt base hit. And you know what most kids will tell you? Kids and college and pro? That's hogwash. Well, that just makes me look like a wimp. Well, do you want to help your team win? Because if you're not able to put the ball in play, then that obviously bunting would help your team if you can lay a bunt down, at least move a guy over. If you're really struggling, and I've seen Major League Baseball hitters struggle and college hitters struggle, and we talked about it before. How many times did we see Alex Gordon hit the ball into the shift weekly because he pulled the ball all the time? Alex Gordon, a professional hitter, every once in a while, he could go the other way. Mike Moustakas was the king of pulling the ball into the shift. And then you know what Mike Moustakas did? Mike Moustakas actually put his ego aside and was like, huh, there's nobody down the third baseline. There's nobody at third. He's a left-handed batter. All I got to do is put my bat out and stick it in an angle, and if it's anywhere to the left side of the mound, I'm going to be on. I don't have to be a good bunt. And Mike Moustakas did that a couple times. And guess what? He put his ego aside. He put the ball in play. Kept the line moving. And then, you know what eventually happened? Teams quit shifting. So then he started getting base hits when he pulled the ball. So you've got to be able to, you know, obviously adapt in sports. And so going back to the example I made last night is, if you put the ball in play, even if you weakly put it in play, even if you hit a pop-up to third that should be caught, like I was telling you, whether you weakly chop it to the pitcher, that still makes the defense make a play. The pitcher's got to field it. He's then got to make a throw to first, and the first baseman's got to catch it. Whereas if you take strike three down the middle, there's nothing else anybody's got to do. You just walk back to the dugout. So it is really – I think baseball teams that – know how to put the ball in play at every level. They've got hitters that make contact, even if they don't hit tons of home runs, but as long as they keep making contact, and the less you strike out as a team collectively, the better you should be. What's really frustrating watching Major League Baseball is you look at the box scores in the night, and hey, 14 strikeouts. There's only 27 outs. Like the other day, the Royals struck out 14 times. Over half the outs were strikeouts. As a fan, that's a major problem because you're not seeing the ball put in play. So as a fan, you don't even get to see good defense. All you see is like, okay, that's great. The games are faster. We got a pitch clock. They're banning the shift, so there might be a few more singles. We're seeing more stolen bases. Those are all good things. But we're still seeing many games where over half the guys, over half of 27 outs are strikeouts, which means that half of the innings have no contact. Yeah. Now, that's not exactly fun to watch. Now, if you suddenly have guys bunting a little more often, I'm at least as a fan going to have to see a pitcher make a really good play coming off the mound, or a third baseman charging, or a first baseman charging. At least I'm seeing some action. You know, this last year, back in the 80s, the average time between balls put in play, baseballs put in play, we're not talking base hits, just putting the ball in play off the bat, was 2.5 minutes between batted balls. Last year, it was 4 minutes. Last year, you had to wait. That's time to go to the bathroom, come back, chill, check your phone, and still not miss anything. Mm-hmm. Now, it's quicker because there's more pitches done in a shorter period of time, so it speeds up the amount of batted balls in a given point of time because of the pitch clock. So now, I don't know what the number is now, maybe it's 3 minutes and 20 seconds. That's still a significant amount of time between actual action. And it's gone worse, and it's gotten worse because, one, they allow too much dead time in the past. We've changed that this year with the rules, which I'm all for. But the other part of it is guys trying to hit home runs, guys swinging for the fences, guys trying to hit doubles and home runs and pulling the ball every time. And what happens is you then get less action. And you wonder why strikeouts are so high. The pitchers, I hear this, well, the pitchers are better than they've ever been before. And I'll say, you know what? You're probably right in regards to the depth with your bull. I mean, you got guys, like every guy coming out of bullpen nowadays, I swear, throws 99 to 100. I get that. You only get to see the same pitcher maybe two times through the lineup. I understand that. But another contributing factor to striking out so much and making it easier for those guys throwing 99 is you're trying to pull a 100-mile-an-hour fastball that you never can get around on. So here's a concept. Shorten your swing. More compact. You know, there's a guy that was maybe the greatest hitter of all time. Tony Gwynn. He never struck out. His strikeout numbers are insane. What did Tony Gwynn do? He put the ball in play. Mm-hmm. He used all fields. He was a left-handed hitter. He went left field. He could hit at the center. He had some power. He could pull it from time to time. He knew how to use all fields. He put the ball in play. He's known as one of the greatest hitters of all time. And there's more people, more young people out there, no matter what level. Junior high, high school, college, you really need to put the tape on and start studying Tony Gwynn instead of studying Aaron Judge. I'm serious.
Yeah.
Instead of putting tape on, listen, watching Salvador Perez swing is not a good idea. And I love Salvi, and he's hit lots of home runs, and it works for Salvi. But if you're going to copy what Salvi does, you're going to be in trouble. You need to go back and watch the tape of Wade Boggs and Tony Gwynn. Now, I know they're both left-handed hitters. Those guys were great contact hitters. And you know what? They hit some home runs. They weren't horrible. Mm-hmm. It's not like they only hit two homers a year. They hit some home runs, but they put the ball in play. And they're always near the top for the batting average lead, weren't they? Yeah. George Brett, I believe, walked more than he struck out in his career. George Brett put the ball in play. And George Brett had power. He had seasons where he hit 25, 30 home runs. And he didn't strike out a lot. He put the ball in play. And those are the people that young people need to go watch the tape, even if it's a little grainy. They need to watch the tape or whatever, pull it up on YouTube or video. And those are the hitters you need to study. Younger hitters need to understand and watch those people hit instead of watching Yordan Alvarez try to hit a 500-foot home run for the Astros. Instead of watching David Ortiz, who hit a lot of home runs, or Aaron Judge, or Giancarlo Stanton. Those guys have raw power. All right? Not everybody can hit the ball as far as they do. So know your limitations. And if you can learn how to hit like some of the greatest contact hitters of all time, that'll make not only you a better hitter, but you'll be amazed. You'll start probably hitting more power. You'll probably hit some more homers than you are now because you're using all fields, and it helps your team as well. Mm-hmm. And so I see this at high school, I see it at college, and I still see it at the pros. And it really is really tough to watch when you've got so many of those levels where so many of these players, pro, college, and high school, are trying to pulverize the ball so bad, trying to hit not just a home run, but trying to hit it into the fountains or out of the park, literally, mm-hmm. that you just don't make contact. And that's not, I mean, to me, that makes it a more boring sport.
Absolutely. You watch the Royals, and they're always the example for us, right, in 14 and 15 of doing what you're just talking about. There's, and learning, like you said with Moustakas, of that. You know, if it's not working this way and they're continuing to take this away from me, then maybe I should do something a little different and maybe I should fix it. And when you fix it, then things start getting better and you can actually have a better opportunity to have success. And yeah, baseball has for a while been going the wrong way as far as the highest level of baseball. But at this level that you're talking about where your son, you know, put the ball in play, right? I think it's key just to to development of everything and to make baseball at that level even better when you get to the highest level, right?
Right.
It starts at the beginning and trying to teach these kids, you know, how to play the game the right way or how to swing the bat the right way or what you need to do and how to approach the game at the plate. And so those things are all, I think, important to, you know, making baseball a little bit more interesting and more fun to watch anyway. And I think it can start at the lowest level and get them doing things the right way when they're young. And then they, you know, and Andrew Benintendi is told to change the way he approaches an at-bat. Well, maybe he can be like, nah, that's not the way I want to do it. I don't care what this park is.
Right.
I need to hit how I hit and I need to swing how I swing. And, you know, if you can get that taught early enough and, you know, if you have the right coaches, they're probably going to teach you the right way to do it anyway.
Right.
Even up at the upper levels. And so, yeah, I completely agree with most of everything you're saying there. It's, you know, you want to put the ball in play. It doesn't always have to be sexy with home runs. But, you know, it kind of started there in the late 90s and just kind of evolved into a deal where at the big league level, we want home runs. And it's an interesting way to approach things, but it's also an interesting way to not make the game very fun to watch.
I got a text. Agree with you, but Aaron Judge is a good hitter with a sweet swing. Let me give you some stats to back up my argument. And listen, Aaron Judge has a sweet swing, but he misses a lot. So let's just go ahead. This is a great example. Let's compare Aaron Judge, who last year hit 62 home runs, American League record, right? Let's go ahead and compare the modern-day hitter, which is Aaron Judge. I mean, that's like one of the most popular hitters in baseball right now, right? Are you with me? Aaron Judge, the modern-day hitter. And then I'm going to compare him to George Brett, Wade Boggs, and Tony Gwynn. And by the way, Aaron Judge has a sweet swing. Wade Boggs, George Brett, and Tony Gwynn had sweet swings.
Yeah.
So, here we go. Ready? So, Aaron Judge, last year, hit 62 home runs. That's pretty impressive.
Mm-hmm.
He struck out 175 times. That is, let's see if I can find it here real quick. 175 times divided into 696 plate appearances. He struck out 25% of the time. So every game Aaron Judge played, he struck out at least once on average.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So he has a sweet swing, but he swings through the ball a lot. This year he struck out 32 times already. In 82 at-bats. That's well over 30%.
Yes.
So he might have a... I'm not trying to be mean to the person that sent the text. I'm not trying to be that at all. I'm just wanting to say that you can have a sweet swing, but to me a sweet swing is making contact. Aaron Judge makes contact, he hits the ball a mile and a half. When he doesn't make contact, well, he just doesn't make contact. Mm. That's my point. It's the point I'm trying to make is he doesn't put the ball in play as much as he should. He's swinging for the fences. And it worked. He got all the attention in the world. 62 home runs. Hey, in 2017, Aaron Judge, at the age of 25, hit 52 home runs. He struck out 208 times. He led the league in home runs and strikeouts. That is the modern-day player.
Mm-hmm.
That is the modern-day player. I mean, that is, and by the way, Aaron Judge did bat .311 last year. That's a good batting average.
I remember he was in the hunt for the Triple Crown while going for the record in the American League.
But that's the modern-day hitter, striking out 150 to 200 times or more and trying to hit 40 or more homers. And so Aaron Judge, you look at his numbers, and they're impressive, 133 runs scored, 62 homers, 131 RBIs. You're like, wow, that's amazing. But he still struck out 175 times. So he could have put the ball in, if he puts the ball in play 75 more times and only strikes out 100 times, isn't that better for the team? Now somebody's going to come back and rationalize it. Well, that would take away from his power. Okay, I guess. I don't know. The person texts like, man, I didn't know he struck out that much. I honestly, in fairness, I didn't know he struck out that much either.
I didn't know it was that much.
I didn't either.
I knew he was a guy that struck out more than your general you know, home run hitter from the past might have, or your general hitter from the past might have.
Right.
Especially with a .311 batting average, right? Like, you don't expect that many strikeouts.
Now, he did walk 111 times, so he got on base. Mm-hmm. So that's the way to maybe equate it or equal out a little bit. So Aaron Judge is the prototypical modern-day player, okay? And I'll go with last year. 62 homers, American League record. struck out 175 times. All right, let's go to George Brett. George Brett, in his career, hit 317 homers. The most homers he hit in a year was 30 back in 1985 when they won the World Series. Now, Brett did have some injuries, right? He missed some games, so there were some seasons he probably would hit more than 30, but he was hurt. Do you know that George Brett never struck out 100 times in one single season in 20 years?
Doesn't surprise me.
Do you know the most? Let's have some fun here. What do you think was the worst season for him in regards to strikeouts at the plate? How many times did he strike out? The worst season for him. He played 21 years in the bigs. George Brett did. Hall of Famer. And by the way, he had more walks in his career than strikeouts. George Brett 1 year walked 103 in 1985. When the Royals won the World Series, George Brett walked 103 times, hit 30 homers, 112 RBIs, hit .335, led the league in slug, led the league in OPS plus, OPS, and he only struck out 49 times all year in 665 plate appearances. George Brett. Don't think that helped him win a World Series? I'd say that helped him. But George Brett never struck out 100 times in his career, not a single time. What was the worst, you think, number-wise? How many struck out in a season?
I was going to say something like 82 or something.
The most times he ever struck out in his Major League Baseball career, George Brett, was 1991 at the age of 38, where he struck out 75 times. He walked 58.
Mm-hmm.
That is amazing. You think that's amazing? How about this one? George Brett, back in 1980, when he was flirting with 400, he had 515 plate appearances. You want to take a guess at how many strikeouts, how many times he struck out that year? 515 plate appearances. He hit .390 that year. The Royals made it to the World Series, lost to the Phillies in six games. You want to take a guess at how many times George Brett struck out in 1980 at the age of 27? 515 plate appearances. This will blow your mind.
31.
22.
Man.
Are you freaking kidding me? I didn't know that. I'm learning stuff as we go here. That is insane. In 1979, at age of 26, George Brett had 212 hits, struck out 36 times the whole year. Aaron Judge strikes out 36 times in a month.
Yeah.
Some of these guys, Joey Gallo, probably struck out 36 times in 2 weeks. Okay, so you think George Brett's impressive. George Brett struck out only 908 times in his career. He walked 1,100 times. So George Brett, on average, over 21 years, he only struck out an average of 54 times a year. 54 times a year. Aaron Judge, on average, 162-game average, Aaron Judge strikes out 202 times a year on average. That's on 162 games average. George Brett was 162-game average, 54 strikeouts per 162. So Aaron Judge, now George Brett hit how many home runs here? Home runs, George, oh, darn pop-ups. George averaged, so on 162-game average for his career, George Brett averaged 19 homers, 96 RBIs, 54 strikeouts. Aaron Judge, homers way higher, 49, yeah. 109 RBIs. Brett was 96, so not many more RBIs. Mm. And that means he puts the ball in play more often.
Yeah.
And strikeouts, Judge averaging 202 on a 162-game season. Brett only 54. You think that's good? Let's go to another guy. First name, Wade. What a cool name. Wade Boggs. Wade Boggs led the American League in batting average 5 times. Wade Boggs, for his career, hit .328. George Brett hit .305. Okay. Aaron Judge hits .282 for his career, which is pretty impressive considering all the times he strikes out. Wade Boggs walked 1,412 times and only struck out 745. He walked twice as often as he struck out.
Mm-hmm.
And Wade Boggs had a year where he hit 24 homers. Now, usually he didn't hit a lot of homers. In fact, he was only double digits a couple times in his 18-year career. Wade Boggs, the most times he struck out in a season, 68. In 1988, Wade Boggs hit .366, 125 walks, 34 strikeouts. In 1985, Wade Boggs led the American League in Major League Baseball, 240 hits, hit .368, struck out 61 times in 758 plate appearances. You think that's impressive? Let's go one step further. Tony Gwynn. Tony Gwynn. Tony Gwynn played 20 years. 20 years. Aaron Judge has played 8 years. All right? So Aaron Judge has played 8 years. And he struck out 940 times already. In 8 years, Aaron Judge has struck out 940 times. George Brett, in 21 years, still hasn't caught Judge in strikeouts. George Brett's only struck out 908 times in 21 years. Judge has already passed George Brett with 13 years to spare. Wade Boggs struck out 745 times in his whole career. Tony Gwynn, who won the batting crown 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 years. You know the most times, the number of the most times he struck out in a season? We did George Brett, 75. Wade Boggs was, what, 58 or something? 68. So Brett was 75. Boggs was 68. Tony Gwynn played for 20 years for the Padres. Played for the same team his whole career. Do you know his worst season in regards to how many strikeouts he had? Want to take a guess?
I can't imagine it's over 50. I'm going to say 46.
40. He had the audacity in 1988 to strike out 40 times. Tony Gwynn in his career walked 790 times, struck out 434. Didn't walk as much as Wade Boggs or George Brett, but he put the ball in play. He only struck out 434 times his entire career. That comes out to an average of 29 times per 162 games. To put this in perspective, Tony Gwynn, who hit 135 homers in his career, which isn't horrible, and you don't have the lively, jumpy baseball and all that stuff in some years, as we've seen. Tony Gwynn, in his entire career, struck out 434 times. Aaron Judge almost did that in two seasons. Tony Gwynn, 20 years. Yeah, does Aaron Judge have way more homers? Does he have more RBIs? Yes, he does. Tony Gwynn's career batting average, .338. Never struck out more than 40 times in a season. Tony Gwynn had over 10,000 plate appearances in his career and struck out only 434 times. If you want to learn how to hit the ball, quit watching videos of Aaron Judge and Giancarlo Stanton. Start watching videos of Tony Gwynn. And if you want more power, you say, well, Tony Gwynn didn't hit for a lot of power. Well, look at video of Wade Boggs. Well, he didn't hit for a lot of power. Okay, fine. Then let's go to George Brett. George Brett hit over 300 homers in his career and would have probably been 400 had he stayed healthy. Mm-hmm. And he had to hit in some big, huge parks. I mean, he played it. The Royals Kauffman Stadium was 20 feet deeper to center when he played, if not further. Now, I think it was 440 to center at one point at Kauffman Stadium. I mean, and some people would say, well, the pitching wasn't good back then. And that's true. The guys didn't throw 100 miles an hour as much then. I get that. But the point is that all these guys are Hall of Famers, and Aaron Judge probably will be too in his own way, obviously. And I'm not trying to knock Aaron Judge and say he's a bad player. He's not a bad player. He's a great right fielder. He's got a cannon for an arm. He hits for power. He does get on base a lot. He does take walks. But when it comes to strikeouts, that's the modern-day player. I just gave you the prototypical perfect comparison of the polar opposites. Aaron Judge is the modern-day hitter. Tons of homers, tons of strikeouts. George Brett, Wade Boggs, Tony Gwynn, those are the type of players. I know, oddly enough, they all batted left-handed. There are right-handed batters that are really good at the strikeout either. I just can't come up with one off the top of my head. But young people, if you're 9 years old, 10 years old, 12 years old, a high school player, a college player, you're struggling in the minors, trying to get to the big leagues, maybe you got to change your approach. There's a Pittsburgh Pirate player the other day that got promoted to the big leagues at the age of 33. He's played over 1,100 minor league baseball games. You don't think he probably made an adjustment somewhere, somehow, to stay in the minors? Mm-hmm. And then eventually he got the call-up, which is just awesome to hear. It's a great story. Once again, you want to be a hitter. And a hitter doesn't mean home run hitter. Hitter means hitter. Get singles and doubles. Get on base. Set the table for the big boys. You know, be Tony Gwynn, Wade Boggs, George Brett, and set the table for Aaron Judge. You know?
That's why those guys can have so many less home runs but be close to the same RBIs, because not just them, those guys that you're talking about,
other guys
putting
got
the ball in play.
That's right.
Other guys, that was just the way baseball was played, right? They're getting on base. So whether you're hitting the ball over the fence or not, you're more often than not having an opportunity to at least move somebody or drive them in. And if you have, you know, a swing that's going to go into the gap or things like that, you're going to work the field and be able to hit in all directions like a Tony Gwynn.
Right.
You know, you're getting many RBI because other guys in front of you in the lineup are doing the same things. It's like, how many solo home runs do we see so much in the game right now? And I mean, the other night was a perfect example of it on Sunday. I mean, there were 7 runs scored. 6 of them were on solo home runs.
Yeah.
And so you're not, that's not helping your RBI count. It's 1-for-1. It's
right.
A homer and an RBI.
That's right.
And that's it. But, you know, if you're playing the game the right way, then your RBI totals are going to go up even if your home run totals don't.
Right.
And so that's the key, I think, is as far as to add on to what we're talking about here, is you don't have to be that home run hitter, and it's about putting the ball in play. And whether you're great at doing that on a consistent basis like a Tony Gwynn or Wade Boggs, or if you just know how to approach it and do it the right way, then things are going to work out for the team in the end.
No doubt. You know, Todd says it's all about power today, which was what we said. Mm-hmm. He homered more last year than Boggs, Brett, Gwynn combined. Well, that's not, I mean, not in one season he didn't, but I don't know what he means by that. But yes, Judge has a lot of home runs in his career. His home run total is 226. Brett by himself still has more. So I don't know where you get the whole home runs combined thing. Judge is obviously on pace to go way past George Brett for home runs, although Judge is 31, believe it or not. Maybe older than some people think. He's had injury problems. He's missed some games because COVID wrecked one season. And I'm not saying all this stuff to bag on Aaron Judge. That wasn't the reason I brought this up at all. It's just that Dusty mentioned, I think, Aaron Judge hitting home runs. And I was like, well, let's pull up the stats and look. And Aaron Judge, as I said, he's walked a lot. He gets on base. His on-base percentage was very high. He led the league in runs scored. Of course, he is on the Yankees, who are always at least good. 62 homers, 131 RBIs. It's a different way of being effective. He's a very good defensive player, is Aaron Judge, as a cannon in right field. He's a complete player. He can run fairly decently, although, you know, obviously home run hitters don't usually steal bases much anymore. He had 16 steals last year. So Aaron Judge is probably, you know, Mike Trout's probably the epitome of the five-tool player right now, although Trout doesn't steal many bases anymore. He did when he first came up. So the five-tool player, you know, who is it? You know, is Aaron Judge a five-tool player? I mean, it just depends on your opinion. You know, Carlos Beltran was a five-tool player without question. I think a five-tool player means you got, you know, you steal bases, you got speed, you can hit, you're a great defender. I think Aaron Judge is more of a four-tool player, and there might not even be a five-tool player in the league anymore. It's very possible, and there probably wasn't very many five-tool guys back in the day when Brett played either, to be honest with you. But it just goes to show you how the game is so much different. You know, games were quicker back then. And now they're slower and take longer, except for this year with the change in the pitch clock to speed up the game. You have way more strikeouts. And the thing that we don't even quantify here, and this is the part I really am bothered by, is if you strike out, okay, so be it. But what happens is the running game stops. When Aaron Judge comes to the plate and the Yankees have a guy on first, are they going to try to steal second? No, you just killed the running game. You're absolutely like, well, we're waiting for him to mash. Well, that's great. He had 62 homers, but the odds are he's going to strike out more than he's going to homer. He struck out 3 times as often as he homered, which I know home runs are not easy to hit. But the point is, Aaron Judge struck out 3 times as often as he homered. So why are we sitting here waiting on a homer when the guy's at first? Because 2/3 of the time he's going to strike out. So why not go ahead and steal second so he's in scoring position for the next guy after Judge strikes out? Isn't it amazing how coaches think now, managers? Well, we don't want to get the guy thrown out at second because Judge can hit the homer. Well, the flip side, he strikes out 2/3 of the time compared to hitting a homer. Whereas, you know, George Brett, Tony Gwynn, Wade Boggs, you could do hit and run. There's another thing you don't see in baseball much anymore. You know why you don't see hit and runs a lot? Because guys don't make contact. You don't do hit and runs anymore. It's one thing that you don't steal bases, but you don't do hit and runs because everybody's swinging for the fences. So if you do a hit and run, it's a swing and a run, and then the guy might be thrown out. So you don't even see hit and runs. That used to be a fun part of baseball. You don't see hit and runs because guys are swinging for the fences instead of just putting the ball in play. Here's an idea. I'm a right-handed batter. We got a hit and run on. Well, okay, the second baseman's going to come over and cover. Well, then I can go ahead and I can hit it the other way. I'll hit it right through the hole. Boom, first and third. We're in business, right? No. You don't see people playing the game that way anymore, at least not at the big league level. We rarely see it. And Dusty, I was pointing this out. One of the things that really bothers me about swinging for the fences, listen, home runs are fun to watch, don't get me wrong. Although after a while, you're just kind of like, hey, it's a home run. You don't see as many stolen bases, but not only that, you don't see hit and runs because guys can't put the ball in play. Mm-hmm. And the argument that you always hear is, well, you think the guy's running at first base? He's got really good speed. Judge is at the plate. Oh, no, he ain't running. Why? Because they're waiting on Judge to hit a homer. Well, I don't want to get thrown out at second stealing because Judge, he can hit homers. But the thing is, if you actually do the analytics, as people like to talk about, you're better off stealing second than standing there waiting for a homer. You know why? Because Aaron Judge struck out three times as often as he hit a homer. So your odds are that every two out of three times you should steal because he's going to strike out. Mm-hmm. And at least you'd have a guy at second for the next guy with a runner in scoring position. Instead, you wait for him to hit a home run, and he might, obviously. He strikes out, the guy's still sitting at first. And that's the thing I don't like about Major League Baseball anymore. I can't stand the just swinging, not shortening up on your swing with two strikes, not putting the ball in play. It kills the running game. I loved watching Ricky Henderson and Willie Wilson and Lonnie Smith and those guys steal bases. I loved it. Absolutely loved it because it put pressure on the defense. I love when we steal bases with our 9-year-old team. I love seeing teams put pressure on the opposing defense. You're not putting any pressure on the opposing defense other than the hitter. Maybe he strikes the fear in God in the pitcher. That's the only thing you're doing. You're not putting pressure on the defense when you strike out. You hit a home run, you're not putting pressure on the defense there because they don't have to go catch it. It's gone. I mean, there's no pressure on the defense. That's what made the 14-15 Royals so good. And I miss it. I do. I truly, truly miss it. And so, while I respect Aaron Judge, I think he's a great player. I wouldn't say he's a five-tool player. Some people may. He stole 16 bases last year. Once again, that people don't steal bases much anymore. It used to be you stole 100, you led the league. Now you might steal 40 and you could lead the league. But home run seasons are up, right? We have tons of 50 home run seasons, 60 home run seasons, 40 home run seasons. Guys that, you know, we used to have no 40-40 guys or 30-30 guys. Now we have many 30-30 guys. Well, we used to. Now we don't steal bases, so we don't even have that. We don't even have that anymore. But we Canseco was the first one to do it. That was pretty awesome. And we just don't do the small things anymore because it's all about, you know, chicks dig the long ball. That's really what it comes down to. Chicks dig the long ball. They don't dig stolen bases. They don't dig hit and runs. They don't dig safety squeezes. They don't dig bunts. They don't dig line drives. They dig bombs. That's what the chicks dig, is the long ball. You've seen the commercial. Remember that? Mm-hmm. With Sosa McGuire and Heather Locklear, I think it was, which I love Heather Locklear, by the way. That's the difference. The modern-day player is Aaron Judge, and the players that really were great at hitting the ball and not striking out and still hit for some power, like George Brett, those are the people you need to start following. Pull up the old videos, watch how they hit the ball, study them, and quit trying to hit so many damn home runs all the time. That's my advice.
It's good advice.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you. Dusty's not a big baseball guy, so he's probably like, let's move on. Well, sorry.
I've given my piece about it, and I understand exactly what you're talking about. So let's put the ball in play. Let's see what we can do.
So I guess the message is, if you're struggling, just shorten down and just work on putting the ball in play first. If you're having problems with contact, work on putting the ball in play. Then we can build up from there, you know? It's tough to watch even major league hitters just strike out time after time after time. You're like, dude, you're a major league hitter getting paid a lot of money. Make an adjustment. The Royals need to make adjustments.
46 points for Jimmy Butler.
Okay.
Sets up a springboard! Why not?
I accidentally hit that button, but you know what? I might have done myself
fine.
A favor.
He doesn't
favor.
Need to make adjustments.
Jimmy Butler doesn't make adjustments. Well, you know, we'll go to something more positive. Jimmy Butler was on fire last night. 56 points. The Heat are up 3-1 on the Bucks. 119-114. The Bucks are down 3-1. Only 13 NBA teams have come back for 3-1 to win. The Bucks are in control. They're up 12 with 6 minutes to go, and then Butler went nuts. He had 22 in the first quarter. He had 19 in the fourth. And the Heat came all the way back to win. It was the first 50-point game in Heat playoff history. Remember, LeBron played for the Heat. Dwayne Wade did. Butler, 56, tied for fourth most points in an NBA playoff game. You know who holds the record?
This is still Mike.
It is Michael 63. Jordan, 63, and a loss.
Yeah.
And it took double overtime to get those 63, it should be pointed out. I remember watching that game as a young kid. And Jordan and Larry Bird, after the game, saying, the closest thing to God and a basketball player is Michael Jordan.
Yeah.
I remember that. Brook Lopez led the Bucks with 36. Giannis had he was back, had a triple double, 26 points, 13 assists, 10 rebounds. But watching that game, the Bucks just self imploded at the end. It's like they were rattled, like young rookies. They were rattled. The crowd was going nuts. Butler was going nuts. They turned it over. They coughed it up. It just was not a good look for the Bucks. So if they would lose the series, the Bucks, they're the one seed. They'd be the first. They'd be the first one seed to be eliminated in the first round since the Bulls in 2012, and that was because Derrick Rose had a torn ACL in Game 1, didn't play the rest of the series. D'Angelo Russell had 3 three-pointers in a row, and that dragged the Lakers back into it after trailing by 7 with 5 minutes to go against the Grizzlies. LeBron tied the game at 104 apiece on a layup with 0.8 remaining, high-arcing bank layup over defensive player of the year, Jaren Jackson Jr., and the Lakers go on to win 117-111 overtime over the Grizzlies. John Morant struggled, just 8 of 24 from the floor. LeBron James, 22 points, 20 rebounds, 7 assists. Lakers up 3-1 in the best of 7. Tonight, there are 3-5 game 5s on the schedule. In the East, the Hawks are trailing the Celtics 3-1 in Boston for game 5 at 6:30 on TNT. In the West, Nuggets and Suns both have 3-1 leads. 8 o'clock NBA TV, Nuggets host the Timberwolves, and Nuggets chance to close it out in Denver. At 9 o'clock on TNT, the Suns are at home against the Clippers in game 5. They're up 3-1. Kawhi Leonard, and, of course, Paul George has been out the whole series. Kawhi Leonard is still a no-go in Game 5. So Kawhi Leonard, Ty Lue says he's hurt worse than people think. Okay, well, then tell us what it is, but whatever. And now, unfortunately, we will go back to baseball real quickly.
Moreno on the move. That one squirts fair. Pasquantino coming home. And he's in there. It rolls all the way to the backstop. Moreno stops at third. Ahmed's at second, and it's 5-4 Diamondbacks.
Well, the Royals led at one point last night, but they, of course, could not hang on. The Royals lose to the D-backs. That was the winning run. The Royals are able to take a lead early on Edward Olivares' home run, up 1-0. Salvi tied the game, RBI single in the third. D-backs went up 4-2. Royals come back and tied the game. Kyle Isabel with a clutch hit to score Michael Massey in the eighth, but the D-backs score the final run on a fielder's choice, a throwing error by Vinny Pascatino in the eighth. And we've talked about it. Vinny's not a great defensive first baseman, and this goes back to the whole Salvi's blocking certain people. And we don't blame Salvi. We love Salvi. But for the future betterment of the team, it'd be best if, at worst, he just DHs all the time. Or just, yeah, trade him. But I don't know what you're going to get for Salvi right now, his age and everything else. And I don't say that loosely. We talked about it the other day. I don't want to beat up the point. Royals are 5-18 now in the season. Brad Kelly gave up 4 runs, 95 pitches in 4 innings. He needs to take some advice from Quinn Eilert. Quinn had 60 pitches in 5. Keller's playing against maybe better competition. 95 pitches in 4 innings is very, very pitch inefficient. D-backs are 13-11. Game 2 of the 3-game set tonight at 8:40 in Phoenix. Brady Singer on the hill, 1-2 with ERA over 8, and he was a Royals pitcher of the year last year. Where will the hope come from? Where is there hope? When will things turn around? I have no idea. I really don't. And since I don't, let's move on to the last thing on my list. Actually, two more things. Braves starting pitcher Spencer Strider. I saw him in person last year in Atlanta. He is one hell of a pitcher. Mm-hmm. The guy last night was a story at Truist Park. As the Braves hit, what do you know, 5 home runs and 11-0 win over the Marlins. But the story is Spencer Strider. He had a perfect game through 6 innings, and then there was a regular easy ground ball to first, and Matt Olson pulled a Bill Buckner, booted it. That blew up the perfect game. Then they go in the eighth. He still had a no-hitter on the line, and a guy hit one off of the ground. It was a great pitch. It was like a Salvi golf shot, except it didn't go out of the stadium. And just over the third baseman's head for a base hit, broke up the no-no. Spencer Strider, 8 innings, 2 hits, struck out 13. Didn't walk a guy. This is the interesting part. The outing by Strider marked the 9th consecutive start. He struck out 9 or more. That sets a new franchise record for the Braves, topping John Smoltz's old record of 8 straight during the 97 season. And you're going to see more and more of these pitching stats. Because batters will not put the ball in play. They swing for the fences. That's why Spencer Strider, who has great stuff, is able to strike out nine guys or more in nine straight starts. Wouldn't you think one team somehow, some way he played would shorten up, maybe even bunt or... I digress. And the final thing I have is... No, two more things. Goodness gracious, there's still more. Aaron Rodgers has been traded to the Jets. How could I forget that? Packers agreed to trade the four-time MVP to New York for multiple picks yesterday afternoon. Green Bay swapped their 15th pick in the first round for the Jets' 13th pick. And the Packers give up a fifth-round pick in this week's draft as well. The Packers, in return, get a second and sixth-round pick from the Jets and a conditional second-round pick next year that would become a first-rounder if Rodgers plays 65% of the plays this season, which seems to be likely unless Rodgers would have a season-ending injury. Rodgers played all 18 of his seasons with the Packers. It's the most by any Packer player in history. He leaves the Packers as the franchise all-time pass TD leader at 475 touchdowns, second in passing yards only behind Brett Favre. Did the Jets give up too much for Aaron Rodgers?
I think it's kind of, for me, it's where I think it should be.
See, I totally disagree with you. And here's why. Who else was trying to trade for Aaron Rodgers?
That's fair. I have no idea if anybody else was.
There was no talk of anybody else interested in Aaron Rodgers. Aaron Rodgers, this is where the Packers should thank Aaron Rodgers. Aaron Rodgers went on Pat McAfee's show about 30, 40 days ago and said that he was going to play for the Jets, basically. And the Jets, you can see the moves they made. You could tell that they were going to get Aaron Rodgers. And they were going to do what... And the Packers knew the Jets wanted him badly, and the Packers held out until the week of the draft. They thought about even waiting past the draft, actually. Mm-hmm. But they thought it'd be good for both organizations, and probably more so for the Packers, to know for sure that Rodgers is gone before the draft. And so here we go. The draft starts Thursday in Kansas City at Union Station. Boom. Rodgers is traded on Monday. Who were the Jets competing against? Because do you really think Aaron Rodgers was going to be the quarterback for the Packers at the end of the day when he went on a national show and said, I'm going to play for the Jets? Like, do you really? The Jets had the Packers in a corner, and they let him out. And the Packers kind of knew that the Jets had already played all their cards, and Aaron Rodgers didn't do the Jets any favor. So the Jets, other than force his way out, I guess. So the Jets are like gave this up. And I agree with you. On the surface, it doesn't seem horrible, although they got to take on his salary.
Mm-hmm.
That's hurting. On the surface, it doesn't seem horrible. He is 39 years old. They're getting a 39-year-old quarterback who's coming off one of his worst years last year. Now, granted, didn't have as many weapons, so forth, played with a broken thumb or a bad thumb throughout most of the year. I don't know if it was broken. But the Jets, you were competing against yourself. So I think the Packers did great to get what they got. The Jets got what they wanted was Aaron Rodgers. But what? How long a window is this?
Mm-hmm.
2-3 years? I mean, going to be 40 here not too long. I don't know, man. And then suddenly they're a Super Bowl contender. How in the hell are they a Super Bowl contender suddenly? They didn't even make the playoffs last year.
They're a playoff contender, I would say, with Aaron Rodgers.
But not a Super Bowl contender, are they?
No.
I mean, the Packers weren't a Super Bowl contender last year. They didn't make the playoffs. So why are they automatically a Super Bowl contender? Listen, the Chiefs clearly, don't forget the team that won the Super Bowl for the second time in 4 years. The Chiefs, the Bengals, the Chiefs and the Bengals are better than the Jets. The Bills are better than the Jets. You could argue the Dolphins are better than the Jets if Tua's healthy. And you could maybe argue the Chargers are better than the Jets.
That's what I would say. I would say just going
with Lamar
right
Jackson
now,
healthy, the Ravens are better than the Jets.
Going right now, the Chargers are better than the Jets, I think. But that, depending on what else would happen with each one of those teams, you never know what will happen once the season starts. But
do you buy that they're a Super Bowl contender just
not.
Like that? I don't
no.
either. Now, you will have more weapons, though. Garrett Wilson, Breece Hall comes back for a torn ACL, a running back hopefully from Wichita. Hopefully he'll be good. Garrett Wilson, they might draft an offensive player with the 15th pick now. But everybody knew this was going to eventually happen. It did. Rodgers gets his way, getting out of Green Bay. Green Bay hands the keys to Jordan Love. And, you know, you go back and look at when did things go south. It's when they drafted Jordan Love. And I still, to this day, didn't understand why they drafted Jordan Love. Now, Jordan Love goes out, plays like an MVP, Packers look like geniuses. Of course, some people said, why did you draft Aaron Rodgers when you had Brett Favre? Well, because he was the best available player on the board, and we didn't think he'd fall all the way to the end of the first round. That's why they took him. That ended up being a pretty good move. So maybe the Packers know what they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, though, man. We don't get him any weapons the last few years. Colorado Buffaloes have wrapped up their first spring practice session. They had a spring game over the weekend. under their new head coach, Deion Primetime Sanders. And now, since the spring game, 15 players have entered the transfer portal. Wide receiver Montana Lamonius Craig, what a great name, is one of the highest-profile players to make the decision to leave Boulder. The junior made waves on Saturday. He had three catches for 154 yards and two touchdowns during the spring game. By the way, did you see the spring game last year? They hardly had anybody, 2,000 people at the spring game Boulder, and this year it was basically sold out because Deion's the head coach. They broadcast the spring game on ESPN, for crying out loud. Mm-hmm. Now, that just tells you the power of Deion. And so this guy, he's transferring. He was the second-leading receiver on the team last year. Their top receiver last year is also transferring. He announced it yesterday, and Jordan Tyson. And their top running back for last year, Deion Smith, is transferring as well. Now, you could sit here and go, whoa, what is Deion doing? He's crazy. This is bad. He's got a mutiny on his hands. He lost his two best receivers and his best running back. Wait for it. From a team that went 1-11.
Exactly.
This goes back, if there are Colorado fans that aren't understanding what's going on, John Bowden will attest to this. I'm sure Mark Johnson, the play-by-play voice of the Colorado Buffaloes, will attest to this as well. This is the same type of thinking by some Colorado fans that I've seen on message boards and on social media, and even people nationally that don't understand what's going on. It's the same thinking that K-State fans had when they're like, oh my God, we're losing Nigel Pack. Oh my God, we're losing this guy and this guy. You had a losing record. You want the same guys back and want the same season? I mean, it's called shopping for your own groceries, as Bill Parcells would say. And what do you know? K-State went out and got some dudes, and they knew what they were doing. And you don't want the exact same team from last year if you were bad. Why do the Buffaloes want all? I mean, yeah, would these guys be maybe role players on this year's team? Maybe they would start. Maybe they would be good players. I think Deion Sanders is going, listen, I'm cleaning house, and I'm going to bring in dudes. And you know what? Colorado may suffer some this year because of that. That's very true. They might be short scholarship players, this and that, whatever. But if Deion is really in for it for the long term, and I mean with Deion, the long term, 5 years. Because I don't think he's in. I don't think Deion's there more than 5 years. I don't even know if they're more than three. But Deion's basically, and he was point blank and told all the players, like, you better be hitting the portal. Like, these are not his dudes. I'll give him credit for being blunt and transparent. Some people don't like it. Mm-hmm. And the players that were there, I'm sure, like, oh, there's a new sheriff in town, and he don't like us and didn't even get a chance to know us. Well, but it's his company, basically, now. And he can do whatever. He can fire all the employees if he wants and bring in his own people. It sucks for the people that have been there for a while, but technically he can do it. And that's what he's doing. Now, whether it's going to work out and the Buffaloes are going to be a great college football team again, like the days back when Bill McCartney was the head coach and they won a national championship, I don't know if they'll get there at that point. There's lots of rumblings, no pun intended, with the Buffalo. What's the name of Ralphie? Yeah, Ralphie the Buffalo. But there are a lot of rumblings that, and I said this a few weeks ago, and now it's become more of a national story a little bit more lately, that Colorado eventually is coming back to the Big 12. Now, there's no official word on that, but there are lots of rumblings that Colorado, along with maybe another Pac-12 team or two or three, are going to join the Big 12. And if that's the case, then you know, that'd be great for the Big 12. You bring on an improved Colorado football program in a year or two or 3 years, and Deion's still the head coach. I mean, that there's a, you know, you lose OU in Texas, but you have Colorado with a name like Deion. That would be nice for the Big 12. So we shall see. But a lot of people are kind of freaking out that don't really know what's going on, I think. Oh, my God, 15 people transferred after the spring game. I will say this. It is weird for that many people to transfer after a spring game. That is very odd. Okay? But I think it was basically those players wanted to stay, and most of them stuck around, and this was kind of the litmus test. And then I'm guessing the coaching staff said, yeah, you're just not going to figure in the next year. You're not going to play as much as you think you will. Now, I don't know about the two receivers and the running back, but it is interesting how Deion Sanders is going about things at Colorado, and I'm really fascinated to see how it works out for him and the Buffaloes.
I don't know anything inside information about it, but I would guess that half of those 15 people were cut.
I would imagine so, too.
I mean, it's
probably
technically
more than
being
half.
Cut, but right. At least half of them were just said, hey, thanks for sticking around so we could see what you had here during the spring, but you're just not going to fit in.
Exactly.
And, I mean, there was an exodus of some of them even before the spring started.
Yes, there was.
And so, but that's exactly like, if all you saw was all these people left after the spring game and you didn't understand what had actually happened in the whole process before the spring, then yeah, you could probably have some kind of weird reaction, but that was all over when Deion went in and had that first meeting with the whole group and said, some of you guys are not going to be here. He's like, I'm bringing in my guys, too. And he wasn't just talking about coaches. He was talking about bringing in players from Jackson State, too. And so, and other guys that he wanted to be a part of this. And it's not that hard because he literally did say some of you guys should probably hit the portal.
Right.
Like, you should probably go find somewhere else to play because this isn't for you anymore.
And some of them waited till now.
Yeah.
And then others, like you said, maybe be like, oh, you know, okay, yeah, all right, we saw a look. We got a look at you. No, you're not here. And the Buffaloes have added nearly 30 transfer players already under Deion Sanders. But now they have 15 or 16 now departing due to the transfer portal. So like I said, it's going to be very intriguing and fascinating to see what happens in Colorado with the Buffaloes. And I will tell you one thing about Deion Sanders is it won't be boring.
No.
It will not be boring. And his son looks like he's an athlete. I mean, if he's any chip off the old block, he's going to be a heck of an athlete. And they got don't they have a wide receiver that came from Jackson State, too?
I believe so, yeah.
A Hunter kid, I believe.
Yeah. Actually, off the top of my head, I don't remember many of the names.
I think they connected in the spring game. So, they're going to be interesting to watch. I don't know if it's going to translate into – here's the thing to Deion. I think Deion is brilliant from this standpoint, too. If Deion took this job and the Buffaloes last year were 6-6 or 5-7, I don't think Deion could do what he's doing.
No.
Because you're like, you're supposed to take us the next step to be, you know, win the Pac-12, right?
Yes.
When you're 1-11, Deion, and he's probably even said it, Deion can easily come in and say, listen, you hired me to take over a 1-11 team. Don't even start telling me how to do my job. You hired me to clean up this dumpster fire. You overpaid for coaches that didn't work out. You've paid me. Don't even tell me what's the wrong or right way to do it because you sure as hell didn't know how to do it. You're a 1-11 last year. And that's what he's done. He's come in and basically said, I'm changing the culture and we're going to do things differently here. And I got dudes that are coming in and you know what? You guys might not play, so you might as well hit the portal. And that seems mean and cruel, but at least it's honest. At least I think it is. And it's transparent. And I think we need that sometimes in today's society. And these kids, I think, for the most part, knew where they stood. Now, maybe not. Maybe he misled some of them. It's possible. Maybe some misconstrued or misinterpreted what he said. That's always possible.
Mm-hmm.
But I think at the end of the day, he's saying, listen, we're 1-11. And so if Colorado this year goes 4-8, will people be upset in Boulder that they went 4-8? I don't think there'll be a lot of people upset about it because if they see the flashes of brilliance from his son at quarterback and other players, they're going to be like, well, dear God, imagine what he can do when he has a full year to recruit and he's got his own dudes. So, and also, if you go 4-8 or 5-7, that's well better than 1-11. See, if Deion comes in and he cleans house and he acts like he's the dictator, okay, and it's his company to run, as I said, and they were 5-7, and he comes in, he cleans house, and they go 3-9, there are way more questions, aren't there? But he comes in following a team that was 1-11. There's nowhere to go but up. So he's got a little bit of grace period here. He can easily win 2, 3, 4, 5 games, and that's it. Not even have a winning season. Maybe not even make a bowl. And it'd be like, oh, he's building something. But if they go out there and win 6 or 7, then he knows exactly what he's doing, and he did the right thing. But even if they go 1-11 again, doesn't mean he did the wrong thing. You got to give it some time. And I think Colorado is going to be a little bit more patient than some football programs that want instant gratification, as we know.
2-10 is improvement.
Yes, sir. It is.
So, yeah, it's easy for a coach to come into that kind of situation. And like obviously the parallel with K-State basketball is that, you know, if I'm a fan of Colorado football, I want there to be a major shakeup with my roster. I hate that that's how college sports are nowadays.
Right.
That's a different story. But, and the way some schools and players use the transfer portal, I'm not a huge fan of some of that, but that's a different story. for as a K-State fan, the absolute only player that I would have even been like, I kind of wish I won him back is Nigel Pack. The rest of those guys that left, it's like, well, those are Bruce Weber guys, and we were not good last year. And we're not haven't been real good over the last couple years, really, with these Bruce Weber guys. So, yeah, you want to get your own guys into a system as quickly as possible. And if that means sacrificing maybe three or four more wins in a given season in football, yeah, or if that means, you know, sacrificing a chance to play in the NIT instead of the instead of going home in basketball, then you'll do that. Right. It's like, okay, we're bad, but I don't need these guys to stick around just so I can be good enough to make the NIT. So just so I can be good enough to make this lowest tier bowl that the Pac-12 has, right?
Right.
And so, yeah, get your new guys in there as quick as you can and move forward. But it is. It's a lot different if you're inheriting a team that made the tournament in the NCAA,
yes,
or that made the Alamo Bowl, say, in college, right, and you're trying to, you know, make it up to the next level. Then, yeah, you probably don't have the kind of leeway. But you also have a coach that might not have been getting fired in those situations. And you know, the different situations of, was the coach fired or did he leave, and all those things that go in with it as far as changing. To fit a program the way you want it as a new coach. And so, yeah, this is a perfect example of, let's just clean this whole thing up. And if I win one or two games next year, doesn't really matter.
One of the things I do appreciate from, and I've heard this from or read a few coaches talk about it, the worst thing you can do as a coach is let other people tell you how to run your program. That's the worst thing you can do. Now, you need to get a great coaching staff so you can bounce ideas off each other so you're not a dictator. You know, you need to be able to listen to ideas and form a good team of coaches for your staff. But I've also read and even heard that whatever you do, when you get your coaching job, do it the way you want. That way, if you get fired, you at least did it your way. There are coaches that have said after they've been fired from jobs, especially their first jobs that they got, they have said, my mistake was I let too many outside influences influence what I did, and I didn't really truly do it the way I wanted to. I didn't stand strong to my convictions when I was hired. So if you're going to go down swinging, doing what you want to do, the way you want to do it, and mold it the way you want to. And if it doesn't work, well, then your philosophy simply didn't work. Instead of molding it to fit other people, and then you don't please anybody, and you get fired in on top of it all. So I think that's what Deion's like. Hey, I'm doing it my way. And if it works, great. And if it doesn't, so what? I got lots of money anyway.
Yeah.
But I'm going to do it my way. And if people don't like it, that's just too doggone bad. But at least I know if I get fired a few years from now, or if it ends up being a dumpster fire again, I at least did it my way. You know, the old Frank Sinatra song, My Way.
Yes.
How about this? Wichita State Softball puts this on Twitter. Wichita State Softball, it is with a heavy heart that we announce tonight's game against number one Oklahoma has been canceled. Not postponed, canceled due to inclement weather in the forecast this afternoon and evening. Wichita State Softball is having a good year. They're going to have a shot at knocking off the number one team, Oklahoma, tonight. And it was going to be in Wichita, I do believe. And the game will not be rescheduled. So missed opportunity for the Shockers, unfortunately.
Yeah.
That is a bummer.
Yeah, and especially people might want to come out and watch the best team, right?
Right. You know, there's a way to solve
chance
all
to have the upset, but also watch the best team if you don't get the upset as a Shocker fan.
Right. There's a way to solve that, and it's really not that difficult. It requires a little bit of money, but just build a dome.
Yeah.
Don't ever play baseball outside ever again. Just never do it. You'll never have these problems. And the Sooner softball team, they are number one in the country. They're 42-1. What who they lose to? 42-1 Oklahoma softball.
So I wonder if it was Texas or something.
Oh, they lost to Baylor 4-3 on February 19th. They haven't lost in 2 months. Softball team Oklahoma 42-1. That should please Clover. And Wichita State was looking for an upset there. Wichita State's having a good year, but that game has been canceled due to the poor weather. 10:32. Yep, there you go. Todd's all super excited about Oklahoma not having to play Wichita State. I think the Sooners are dodging the Shockers. That's what I think. And by the way, for Deion Sanders in Colorado, if you have a good quarterback, that speeds up your process of being good. And his son is very athletic. And if he ends up being the quarterback people think he can be, they're going to win more than two or three games this year. That's for sure.
State, regional, and national sports talk on your schedule. The Sports Ticket Podcast. Subscribe via Apple, Google, and TuneIn Podcasts or SunflowerStateRadio.com.